After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Hi everyone, this is Raghu and this is Ram Dass here and now. And this is a bit of another new program from Ram Dass's Here and Now podcast series. Although we've done a couple of these extemporaneous chats that I've had with Ram Dass. And he thought it was a lot of fun. But I was really happy to be able to spend the time with him. And he said, hey, why don't we do this every Sunday? And I'm like, I don't know about every Sunday, Ram Dass, but let's try and do more of these. So we had this great chat where he was very, very, as he usually is, honest about where he's at, what's been going on, including what's been going on with his body. He said he's getting a little old. I said, yep, we know that. In fact, we all are. This is a wonderful talk, chat with Ram Dass around aging and dealing with suffering and pain. And then we went into little discussion around the Tibetan Book of the Dead, some commentary by John Woodruff that I had found. And it's pretty interesting, and Ram Dass relates his own thoughts about it and what he has been connecting with in terms of the eventual transition that he and all of us are going to be going through. And then we also talked about the so-called differences of bhakti yoga path and the path of non-duality or Buddhism, and devotion, which was also a wonderful thing. I had found this thing, which I actually did on a mind-rolling podcast with my buddy David Silver, around Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche and his emotive reaction to his meeting with the incarnation of his teacher. I hope you enjoy it, and we will do more of these. And by the way, please, please, please continue your support. We really appreciate it for the Be Here Now Network, and of course ramdass.org, and what Ram Dass puts out there, and all of the wonderful media we have from so many years. And you can go to particularly Be Here Now Network, because it's a new network. I mean, we're 4.5 months into it. And we do need that support for the network. A lot of people working on this. And, of course, Jack and Cornfield and Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg and Krishna Dass and Lama Surya Dass and myself and beautiful guest podcasts. Oh, Danny Goldberg is there, of course, doing his rock and rolls, and Chris Grasso. So there's a lot of rich material. And we have this amazing new smartphone app. Heart, mind, one word. Please go and download it. It'd be great. So continue the support as much as you can. And we appreciate all of the feedback that we get, which really helps us to develop content that we hope will help everyone. So here's my chat with Ram Dass. Ram Dass, here and now.
It's a beautiful day.
Yeah.
And Maharaji's present. My body aches and pain. And as it gets painful, I notice my identification with my body increases. I'm beginning to I'm old.
Yes. How are you dealing?
Yeah.
How do you deal with that when you start to identify more with your body when pain comes? How are you dealing with that?
It's my mind. I witness the thoughts. And I love the pain. And I surrender. And it's all karma, my karma.
Now,
yeah.
when you say when you do get pain, and you're witnessing the pain, so that you're going deeper inside yourself to watch the play of this pain. So there is a view from another vantage point that's not caught in the mind, as you just said. And then you say, I love the pain. What exactly do you mean? Is there a way in which you're engaging with the pain within a certain vibratory process inside yourself?
Yeah. Well, the witness is part of the soul. And the soul loves everything. And I witness the pain, but the pain, my attention to my toes, it just pulls back my attention. Pulls back my attention. Pulls back. In my urinary system. Pulls back. And then I almost. Have no pain. Yeah. it's my attention.
So by entering into the witness and entering into the center of spiritual heart, soul, however which way you want to call it, that allows for the absorbing of the attention out of the source of pain, in which case your feet. In which case you were talking about your feet as being a center of attention. I know that at night that's a difficult thing for you because of the stroke, that it's affected that part of your body. So that process allows for you to absorb the attention into this, into the perspective back that goes in back of the identification.
Yep. The perception.
I thought, since we're all a little bit closer to the old transition process, and I found this book that I haven't looked at in quite some time, and I had made some notes in it because it's the Tibetan Book of the Dead, but it's basically what I was really inspired by was a foreword to it, not the actual, it's just commentary on it. Do you remember Sir John Woodruff? I guess he was And he had some really, we could reflect on some of the things he's saying. I'm sure there's some stuff in here that you've been talking about. And partly, there's definitely things that I know we've discussed before, you've talked about in your talks. These are just excerpts, and they're not in any particular order. But he's talking about what happens when a human becomes aware that he is dead. As he carries over with him the recollection of his past life, he at first still thinks that he has such a physical body as he had before. So I guess people do think, you know, after they've died, they don't realize that they have left that body. But what it is, he says, is in fact a dream body, the same as a person sees in their dreams. It's an imagined body which is neither reflected in a mirror nor casts a shadow, and which can do such wonders as passing through mountains and the like, since imagination, with a capital I, is the greatest of magicians. Isn't that, I find that fascinating alongside... It is an imagined body.
Wait a second.
Yeah.
I lost you.
So
imagination.
Yeah. So the person who dies, it still sees, feels that he has a body. And in fact, it's a dream body. It's the same kind of relationship with the body that you have when you have a dream and you see your body or you feel your body. And it's neither reflected in a mirror, nor does it cast a shadow. And it can do wonders.
Yeah.
Imagination is the greatest of magicians, which also harks to what you talk about all the time about imagination in terms of the way that you relate with Maharaji. So this is more substantiation to the reality of that, the power of imagination. Even in life on earth, a man may imagine that he has a limb where he has none. Long after a man's leg has been amputated above the knee, he can feel his toes, or is convinced that the soles of his feet are tickling. In the after-death state, the deceased imagines that he has a physical body, though he has been severed therefrom by the high surgery of death. I love that line. The high surgery of death. Right? So what a role imagination plays.
He's English.
Yeah. Yes. And this is from, I think, you know, this has got to be written right in the earlier part of last century, right?
Yeah.
And then further, there's some interesting things here. Further, at length, the deceased passes out of the Bardo dream world into a womb of flesh and blood, issuing thence once more into the waking state of earth experience. This is what in English is called reincarnation or rebirth in the flesh. The Sanskrit term is samsara, that is, rising and rising again in the worlds of birth and death. Nothing is permanent. All is transitory. In life, the soul complex, that's what he's referring to as that which goes from one incarnation to another, a soul complex. Have you ever heard that term before? Yeah? No. It's in life, the soul complex is never for two consecutive moments the same, but is, like the body, in constant change. There is thus a series of successive, and in one sense, different states, which are in themselves but momentary. There is still a unifying bond in that each momentary state is a present transformation representative of all those which are past, as it will be the generator of all future transformations potentially involved in it. This process is not interrupted by death. There's something there that really kind of helps explain how impermanence is not a scary thing, right? How the fact that if we are a soul complex that is constantly moving and shifting by virtue of the impermanence of life, but it's a unifying bond in that each momentary state is a transformation representative of all those which have passed. And so when the body dies, it's not interrupted by the death of the body. Somehow this made tremendous sense to me. Change continues in the skandhas, the constituents of the organism, other than the gross body, which has been cast off and which undergoes changes of its own. But there is this difference. The after-death change is merely the result of the action of accumulated past karma, and does not, as in earthly life, create new karmas for which a physical body is necessary. Isn't that interesting? A physical body, he's saying, is necessary for the creation of new karma. There is no breach of consciousness, but a continuity of transformation. That's like the central thing, which seems to me to be the most reassuring about this as potential reality. I mean, we're trusting these people, that the Tibetans, right? The Tibetan Book of the Dead. The death consciousness is the starting point, followed by the other states of consciousness. Karma at length generates a fully formed desire or mental action. This last is followed by the consciousness taking up its abode in a suitable matrix, whence it is born again as a birth consciousness. What is so born is not altogether different from what has gone before, because it is the present transformation of it and has no other independent existence. So there's no breach of consciousness, but a continuity of transformation based on this soul complex, which is another word for what the Buddhists call Buddha mind, and what we call, we in the Bhakti tradition or Hindu tradition, call soul.
Call soul.
There cannot be any difference, yeah. Right? I mean, this is kind of gets the closest to explaining how there is no differences here. And then
differences from what?
From the Buddhist concept of no soul, of Buddha mind, is that which is the constituent that moves into the new incarnation, into incarnation after incarnation. Soul, we're saying. So this is getting close to an explanation to me of the reality that supersedes both of those concepts. There is no breach of consciousness, a continuity of transformation. Anyhow, I really love that that explanation. And then, if the series of conscious states are determined by past karma, it may be asked how that liberty of choice exists, which the text assumes by its injunctions to the deceased to do this or to avoid that. Right? When you sit with a dying person, you're repeating all kinds of different prayers: let go, become one, do this, do that. In the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying by Sogyal Rinpoche, of course, many people are using that these days. I did it with my father and my mother and my friend who died just a number of months ago. So injunctions to the deceased to do this or to avoid that. No doubt, even in one individual, there are diverse tendencies. But the question still remains. If the karma ready to ripen determines the action, then advice to the accused is useless. If the soul, quote-unquote, is free to choose, there is no determination by karma. Interesting. Here the answer appears to be twofold, yeah. Apart from what is next stated, the instructions given may by their suggestion call up that one of several latent tendencies which tends toward the action counseled. Further, and this is the best part of the whole deal, this system allows that one soul, by the way, he's calling it soul. He's not calling it Buddha mind, Sir John.
Yeah.
One soul can help another. So there are prayers for an application of merits to the deceased. Just as we find in Hinduism or in Catholicism, the Requiem Mass, and in Islam, the Muslim Fatiha. In this and other matters, one mind can, it is alleged, influence another otherwise than through the ordinary sense channels, whether before or after death. Wow. There is also a tendency to overlook collective karma and its effects. An individual is not only affected by his own karma, but that of the community to which he belongs. Have you ever thought about that? I mean, that made me think about who we are together and the way in which we interact with each other will have some influence, perhaps. Our collective karma will have some influence on our individual karma. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. But I've been calling that the soul
pod. Right. Soul pod, right?
The soul pod.
Yeah.
That's that.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's why, yeah, there's a few things in here that reminded me of some of the things that you have said, and certainly this collective karmic effect would be that soul pod.
Yeah.
And I also like his thing about the soul complex. It makes it more... subtle as to the reality because of the reality of impermanence. I mean, that's obvious. I mean, we all experience that. So with that reality, there is that constant change. So it allows for whatever that thing we want to call it a soul that goes through incarnations. You want to call the Buddhists call a Buddha mind or clear mind or whatever. There is that constant It's it's not immutable. It's mutable to change, obviously. And so that process then would lend itself to say it doesn't stop when the body leaves, when the body goes. And so anyhow, I thought that was somewhat reassuring. Are these thoughts that you've been, have you been working with this kind of stuff? And you just said you're old, eh?
Yeah. Yeah. This is stuff that I'm doing with Mirabai.
You're right.
For the book,
that's right.
On dying.
Right. Right. Yeah, everybody for everybody out there, Ram Dass and Mirabai Bush are working on a wonderful book on the process. It's called well, it's not called anything yet. I don't think it has a title, but it's certainly around death, and it's around I love that, of course, from what I'd love is what Emmanuel said to you a long time back, your disembodied friend. What is it? Death is God, I forgot it. What does he say?
He said, death is like taking off a tight shoe.
Right, right.
And then he said,
I know what he said. We're going to get that. I know, I got it, Ram Dass. I got it. That's because I got my computer in front of me. Dying, I'm cheating. Dying is absolutely safe. That's
safe.
What, absolutely that's safe. And these passages from the commentary by Woodruff, they seem to lend that air about them of...
Yeah.
Of relaxing a little bit on that, but in your day-to-day life, talk about that though. In your day-to-day life, I know you're dealing with aging and pain and so on and so forth. And you're spending a good amount of time on your own. And you opened this whole conversation with the fact that Maharaji's presence is there. What kind of work are you doing related to transition?
Everything is in Maharaji's hands. I got into the pain. Is palpable. And then I started to think about that's the ego. And I witness the ego, but I am soul. And my karma yoga is my pains and aches. Mm. And I, as soul complex, I love them. I love them. Yeah.
What about in actual practice? Is there anything that you're doing, I guess, in a meditative way? I mean, I'm only thinking about myself and what I try to do day to day at some point through in my meditation is to picture Maharaji in my mind's eye, inside, in my third eye, and just bring in his vibration, his ineffable vibration, through either easily seeing him, because all of the times that we were with him, it's easy to bring him in, that physical thing, and then that turns into the real Maharaji. And just absorb into that as a way of practicing when that actual moment comes to transform potential fear. Is that something that makes sense to you, or do you do anything like that in terms of practice?
Yeah. I look at a picture of his incarnation, and I would go with the big Maharaji is as the Lama said,
Suryadas.
Yes, Suryadas. Then I stay in my imagination. Maharaji and I meet in my imagination. And I converse with Maharaji, but there's not words. When I'm doing well with my karma yoga, he will stay as part of my karma yoga. In karma yoga, you deal with experiences in front of you. As much as I'd like it, Maharaji, he doesn't react that my achievements.
He doesn't.
He's there, constant love. He brings me to another plane of consciousness, in which I think it's the oneness. It's the Atman. That's what I will do in my meditation.
Lovely. I wanted to share something else with you. When I last saw you a few months ago in August, Krishnadas and I visited you. Something came up which was about... He had been told that he was proffering the idea, not he, but his people, of an online course. And he had been told, sorry, devotion, Scott, nobody's interested in that, you know.
Yeah.
Remember that? Non-duality. Yeah. That says, yeah. But devotion? So, and also further, there was the whole idea of the death of the guru concept. There's, you know, you are your own guru and, you know, you, all of that. So he sent me an article, right, Krishnadas, and I actually did a podcast about this on Mind Rolling with David Silver recently, about crying. Time to cry or not to cry. It was written by a Tibetan Rinpoche who was close to Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, the great Siddha of the last century. Yeah. So he told his story. He said, "In apparently in Tibet, people don't cry. You're not allowed to cry. Right, because I guess it's such a harsh environment. If you can't let yourself go there, so even his grandma and stuff, you know, no, as a kid, no crying, right? No expressing yourself that way, no moving into that kind of a thing. Now, what happened was, it turns out that this Rinpoche who wrote this story, and his name Dzongzar Rinpoche, he was the incarnation tulku of a teacher of Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. And so they were to, the first time they were to meet, he was a young man, and he got in the car, and Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche apparently was like 6'10" or 11". I mean, he was a huge man, majestic, incredible man, human being. And he got in the car with him, and because Dilgo Khyentse could absolutely feel the presence of his teacher through this reincarnation, right? They were going from one place to a temple, maybe half a day's ride in a car. He cried the whole way. Dilgo Khyentse cried the whole entire way. Out of love for his teacher. So Krishnas, of course, is sending this thing. The Buddhist, they think that, you know, there's no heart, and one of the greatest, you know, so this was the gist of the whole thing. And in fact, one thing I found, I just wanted to read you, this is so great. Somebody wrote, after they read this story, a woman named Connie Moffat wrote, and this is just earlier this year, she wrote, "Thank you so much for this story." And she was writing to the Dzongzar Rinpoche who wrote the story. "It reminded me of meeting Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche in New York in 81 or 82, not exactly sure when. It was in a small interview room, not many people at all. He let people ask questions while he was reading a text, turning the pages. He would listen and answer, but never look up, reading the text while the translator explained what he had said. At any rate, I had had trouble getting to the interview because my excitement and the high energy of it was overstimulating, and I wasn't paying attention and took the wrong subway. So when I thought I would miss the interview, I started to cry and cry and cry. And I couldn't stop, even when I got there. So I asked him, 'What is this? What's this crying?' And he looked up at me with a huge big smile and said, 'That is known as devotion from the bottom of your heart.' Such bliss standing in the glow of that smile." That belies, and I know, and you and I have talked, and you know, this is our video podcast that we're going to put out there and everybody's going to hear and watch. But, you know, we'll tell the truth. You and I have talked at times about Buddhism and the you've talked about people easily getting stuck.
Wait a minute.
Yes. Can you hear me?
I have missed.
Okay. You and I have talked about Buddhism, and you, I'm putting words in your mouth a little bit, but no, you have said the preciousness and the clarity of Buddhist thought entraps people when they don't engage their heart. Am I okay? Not exact words, but you have said that, right? And we've gone back and forth and talked about the idea of people getting trapped in their minds related to non-duality and so on. And especially with Buddhist thought, because it is so powerful and subtle in its concepts and so on. And so everybody, you know, and so all the bhakti people think the Buddhists have no heart at all. And this is why Krishnadas sent this to me to show, look at this great, one of the greatest beings in the last 100 years, Rinpoche's. Look at him and able to completely show his emotion and say this thing to this woman. These tears are devotion from the bottom of your heart. Doesn't that belie everything that...
Sure.
I just thought it was sure. so beautiful. I just wanted to share it with you. I love him, and my God.
Huh. There's an article on my desk on love. It's an interview with His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. I should have read it for this interview. I think now I so meet Buddhists that have such a wonderful heart. They don't have a concept. They mask it with their other concepts. Compassion, for example.
Yeah. And most especially the friends, we have so many, don't we, from the Buddhist community that we've been close to for decades.
Yep.
Sharon Salzberg and Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield and to name but a few. Of course, your real close friend, Roshi Halifax, who can be a tough teacher. I mean, she's been a tough teacher.
Cookie.
Yeah, she's been so for me, and yet has this tremendous love, and it's all based around that and caring and so on. It's pretty pretty amazing. I mean, pretty fortunate. And not to mention, and we've said this many times before, Maharaji certainly opened up doors for us to take Buddhist teachings. There's no doubt about it. From Vipassana to the Tibetans. The epitome of it, of course, is Lama Suryadas, who has Maharaji and Khyentse Rinpoche and Karmapa as three of his primary teachers, gurus. So, I was really glad Krishna sent me this article, and I thought it was just a beautiful thing from Khyentse Rinpoche. You know, that's the reality underlying everything.
I like it. Yeah. Devotion. You and I are bhakti yogis. That's where the heart and the soul we hang out with them. We hang out. It all feels, it's all Guru Kripa, which means the grace of the Guru. And then we sing the names of God. And malas, so on. That bows to oneness. The only thing is that to go there makes us, our yoga, it's us and Guru. And us or God. That's dualism. So we go the dualist path to get to the one. We all go to the same place.
Yeah. As our mentor Dada used to say, whenever we go, Dada Mukherjee, whenever we go to his house, Ram Ram. Every sentence ended with Ram Ram.
Ram Ram.
Ram Ram. Yeah, lovely. So nice to hang out with you. Thank you for the time. This isn't an interview, though. It's not an interview. This is a hangout. Hanging out.
A hangout.
That's our Sunday hangout. I'm going to call it our Sunday hangout.
That's right.
Interview.
It's much more satisfying.
Yeah. I interviewed you in a long time ago when I first met you and brought you to my radio station. Then I interviewed you. All that
in
time.
In Montreal.
Ago. Yeah, right. Yeah. But we've graduated to Hangout after all these years.
Yeah, I think we have. I think we have.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're hanging out with Maharaji.
Yeah. Hanging out with Maharaji. Yeah. Well, love you. Thank you again for sharing some space and time. And
I love you.
You too.
I'm sorry for what, but...
What are you sorry about?
I'm sorry for halting.
Oh, my, nobody cares about that.
My affair.
Aphasia.
Aphasia.
Yeah. No, as you said, when you first came, were able to speak after you got the stroke, and you started talking again, and even and publicly, and you said, boy, one thing now is, this allows for space, spaciousness.
Yeah.
And it does. So by the end of this hangout, which is, you know, just about an hour, the space that's created by this is fierce grace. There we go. Okay.
Rago. Rago, you're... You are a devotee of Maharaji. And I think of you as a friend.
Thank you.
And I love you.
And I love you. Ram Ram.
Ram Ram.
Ram 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 Ram. Till next time. This is Ram Dass here and now. This is your podcast. Our podcast that we've been doing. We're over 100 now. So see you next time on the Be Here Now Network.
Okay.